something coming from somebody's previous life, you know. And people come to the movement, they have their karma that's come to them from their previous lives. It's like being, almost like being dealt a hand of cards in a card game. And, you know, some people are more fortunate than others, what can we say? But, what we look for it is, you know, in cards, you know, it's the skill with which you play your hand. So we have to use everything to help people play their hand. And, of course, the other thing is that in Krishna consciousness, there's an intervention outside of the game. Which is, in astrological terms, it's called Krishna Graha. You know what that means? That's from the seventh canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. This is a term used to refer to Prahlad Maharaj. What's a graha? Do you know what that is? Yeah?
That means one that grabs.
Yeah, an astrological influence. A planet that's an astrological influence. Graha means it grabs you. It controls you. It grabs you, right? It's Krishna Graha. And devotees, there's another planet on their charts.
And we can actually become possessed by Krishna.
Yeah. So Prabhupada translates about Prahlad Maharaj, he was under the strong planetary influence of Krishna. So that's something else that happens. That is a kind of card that you get that turns all your cards into good cards, you know. If you have Krishna in your hand, if you have Krishna, then the Krishna effect on all of the planets is to make all planets auspicious. There are no malefics. They're actually all auspicious.
Prahlad Maharaj, he's something about astrology. Mm-hmm. He said the bad karma is good for spiritual life.
Yeah, sure. Look at Lord Chaitanya's chart. I saw on some devotees' astrology, you know. Short lifespan, disaster for marriage, and insanity. I mean, there are other things too, but yeah, you're like, wow, you go to Monday.
Look at Ramachandra's. Ramachandra was banished.
Sure.
His father died.
Yeah.
You know, his wife was stolen.
Yeah.
Kidnapped.
So, points made. Let's go on. I want to get through something. Socialization on the basis that is contemporary and local. We would call this mode of passion. Attained through participation in the activities, achievements of one's particular group. The individual wins recognition and a sense of social security. This is the adjustment of the average or normal man. Notice he puts normal in quotation marks, meaning he doesn't really, those are called shutter quotes. You don't really believe it. Who does not bother himself about remote problems, world peace, or future destiny, his personal future destiny. Such a man may be like the boy that we were described with the Clean Bill of Health, succeed in laughing and joking about matters, which fills his neurotic brethren with fascinated heart. He's well adjusted, but well adjusted on a less than satisfactory level. You don't want to be well adjusted like that. Socialization of the antisocial, as in the case of gregarious delinquents and criminals. Now, this word gregarious. Gregarious is normally not a bad word. But a gregarious person is very sociable, goes around and has lots of relationships with people. That's what outgoing, sociable. But I want to read to you from another place where he talks about this term gregariousness. What he means by being gregarious. This seems to have been a characteristic term used to describe criminal gangs, delinquents. There's an article by a psychiatrist who talked about the nature of delinquents, the unorganized character of the industrial, social, sexual, and emotional life of delinquents. Now, here he's talking about a psychiatrist who won't say that there's anything wrong. He won't use good and bad, but he uses the term organized and unorganized. But Boysen wants to say, well, unorganized just means bad, you know. So here he says, he's talking about this Dr. Meyerson, the psychiatrist. He goes on to say that delinquents are unorganized in their sexual life as well as their industrial career. Even when married, there is no sense of sentiment or of responsibility. This is what he means by gregariousness now. They are never heroes of tense love dreams or sacrifice for a woman's love. With them, love is merely an appetite to be satisfied. When it is satisfied, the object by which it is satisfied is forgotten. Women, as an occasional playmate, appeals to them. Women as someone to work for, to make sacrifices for, to live with, and anything like companionship has no meaning for them. Their sexual activity never becomes merged with the mores, that is, the morals of the society, and thus socialized. Their sexuality does not evolve into responsibility and sentiment. It thus remains unorganized, and themselves are uninvolved individuals. In their social lives, he finds them gregarious, without any communal feelings. They must be with others and are uneasy when alone. They must be with others and are uneasy when alone. But there is no deep concern for those whom they meet, no loyalty to men or cause. Emotionally, there is no brooding over the past, no fervent building for the future. Their emotional life is shallow, though violent enough for short periods of time. Their mood is that which suits the moment. They have never built up in their lives substantial purposes which will weather the vagrant urges of the present moment. They are thus in their emotional lives unorganized. They have never attained to adult development. That's what he means by gregarious. Sounds like the criminals have won. You don't have this in your book. I took this from another chapter just to illustrate that gregariousness. So this is the characteristic of criminal gangs, antisocial types, delinquents. But I think we can recognize this description. More than what you said. As I said, they've become much more prominent in one out. As I said, he touches women are merely a playmate, as an occasional playmate appears for them. So now we have, this is before there was Playboy magazine with Playmate of the Month and the Playboy philosophy and all this other kind of stuff.
James Bond.
You know, now, you know, they have movies, Godfather 1, 2, and 3, which celebrate this kind of person as almost a cultural standard, you know, for people. And now, of course, what's happened since then is divorces become more and more readily. Women unable to, people, their relationship with the opposite sex is purely of the base and appetite. Love is merely an appetite. As soon as it's not satisfied, immediately, now it's divorce. So actually in advanced countries, so-called advanced countries, the actual approved form of matrimony is called serial monogamy. That's the term the sociologists use, serial monogamy. When people get older, their attractiveness, the sexual partner diminishes, but there's no affective bond that's beyond the body. The men, as soon as they get to be 40, 50 years old, trade their wives in on a younger model. And what happens to the kids? Well, you know, that's part of it. They're just the victims of our, you know, growing as a person through this kind of thing. And no sense of responsibility. The people don't have. So these things, which are characteristic of delinquent gangs and Boysen's times, have become more and more the norm as what you do. Gregarious. So it says that they must be with others. These are these people. They have to be with other people. As soon as they're alone, immediately they're restless. It's got to go out. So constant partying or goofing off, running around with other people. Can't be alone. But while they have to be with other people, they tend not to form very deep relationships with other people. And no deep loyalty. Immediately you can turn on a guy and, you know, bop him. Yeah.
It seems to be one of the reasons why they wouldn't want to be alone is because on those moments when they're alone, they become more reflective and a sense of malaise overtakes them. But that's a little bit, it seems like the doctor who wrote that has a little bit of a biased opinion against him, even though he's using unorganized.
Yeah, sure.
Because he doesn't acknowledge that it's very shallow people, no values, no morals. But the very fact they like to be with other people so that they're reflective signifies they do have a conscience.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's still a conscience, but let me hear what Boyson says about them here. Socialization of the antisocial, as in the case of gregarious delinquents and criminals who support each other in pursuit and interests inimical to social welfare. By thus finding social validation with their own little group, they may escape any sense of inner discomfort and guilt. So they're escaping it, you know, more or less trying to. Insofar as they do not recognize their membership in the larger group, they are not bound by its attitudes. They may, of course, be active agents of destruction to society at large, constituting a cancer-like social formation. So the next one is submergence, which we'll have to get into tomorrow because we've run out of time. A fourth kind of social group. This is the famous book in America by Eric Hoffer called The True Believer. We'll talk about that, fanatics and so on.
Yeah, but this attitude is also likely to be attitude towards the environment, destruction of the environment. People.
Yeah, there wouldn't be any responsibility toward anything. Sure. There's no sense of long-term, but just short-term fulfillment of immediate desires without any long-term responsibility. Okay, so we'll meet again tomorrow. Thank you very much, Prabhupada Ki Jai. Little section on examining this chart, which you have at the end of the first handout and in the second handout two times. And tomorrow we're having our midterm exam, which will cover this chart, things in the chart so far as we've discussed them in class, not the whole chart, just what's come up in class. But we've been talking about these end results, solution of four different levels of socialization. Person becomes somehow or other integrated into a society, and we said he's got different levels. It's clearly superior with the attitude of aspiration, reverence, and faith, which is the attitude, the means of which is acceptance of ultimate loyalties and associated standards, confession and forgiveness, social support and reinforcement. So this is progressive unification on a basis conceived as enduring and in universe and universal valid religious types. Then the second level is that this is the level of, what did he call it? The normal man, in quotation marks, where there's an attitude of confidence and self-reliance. Finding of satisfactory self-expression in social, vocational, and sexual life. The end result of this is what he calls contemporary and local adjustment. Yeah, there it says the normal man. He has something to say about the normal man. I just wanted to show you something else about this in another chapter in Exploration of the Inner World. Where he deals with the distinctive task of the minister of religion. He talks about the unawakened, the last of our groups and the largest, those whom I have called the unawakened. These are the persons usually fairly well adjusted in the vocational, social, and sexual fields who never really come to terms with their ultimate loyalties. They are those who, passively accepting the faith of their fathers, make no determined effort to bring themselves into conformity with its requirements, but go through life absorbed all too often in the petty, the trivial, the selfish, and even in that which makes them loathsome in their own eyes. They are thus forgetful of the issues which are of enduring importance to themselves and to the race. I am ready to take the duty that it is the church's duty. I am ready to take the position that it is the church's duty to save such men and to recognize that in order that they may turn and be made whole, it may be necessary to disturb their conscience in regard to the quality of life they are living. And this ought to be done before they perhaps develop symptoms which bring them to some such institution as ours, that is, a mental institution. It may seem heretical to my medical friends to speak of the desirability of producing an emotional disturbance. I would make it clear that such a disturbance would be only incidental to some needed adjustment. No good physician hesitates to inflict pain in the course of a treatment that brings health. So he says, I would further remind them that our findings indicate that the sense of guilt, the self-blame, and the emotional disturbance which accompany it are not in themselves evil, but attempts at a cure. The real evil is the failure to attain the level of adjustment called for in some new period of development, and the short-circuiting of the vital energies through easy satisfactions. Some plan of evangelism must therefore be an essential part of the church's program. This does not mean that we need to have to go back to evangelism of the old type that has many shortcomings and so on, treatment without diagnosis. He has a critique of standard Christian evangelism, treatment without diagnosis, but he wants to come to a new level of evangelism. But anyway, that's his position on the normal man. He doesn't actually think it's very satisfactory. Just like, those are the people to whom we usually preach. The normal person. Contemporary local adjustment. Then a third group of third level of socialization, the attitude flippancy, carelessness, and gregariousness. We talked about gregariousness yesterday. The forming of having obsessive need for continuous social relations on a very shallow basis without any kind of deeper bonding. The making light of accepted standards, rejection of primary loyalties, and seeking of social validation in antisocial groups. This is the rebellion and development of cancer-like social formations, delinquent and criminal gangster. He says, he talks about this socialization on lower levels. And we can see this formation in our own movement. He says, he talks about a certain person who ended in a mental hospital with the obsessive idea of getting God, had to meet Satan. That was his ideation while he was undergoing his crisis experience, that somehow God and Satan had to meet each other and be reconciled. Many are the devices and marvelous the elaborations by which men everywhere seek to avoid condemnation before that inner tribunal known as conscience. One of the very common methods of avoiding such condemnation of consciousness is that represented by our patient in his attempt to shift his loyalties. Shifting of loyalties, right? In its extreme form, we see this in the delinquent and the criminal, who are at one with themselves but at odds with society. They solve the problem by refusing to recognize their membership in the larger community. Therefore, they don't care what they do to it in the process of getting satisfaction. Such persons may have been reared in a social environment which is normal, in which it is normal to be delinquent. Commonly, however, their attitude results from rebellion against the primary loyalties and their associated standards. The true delinquent and criminal is characteristically a member of some group. He is, as Dr. Meyerson pointed out, uneasy when he is alone. The thief must belong to some group and have some sense of social support to avoid going insane. There are thus multitudes of men and women who, like our patient, attempt to get rid of the sense of moral failure by identifying themselves with groups which condone or approve the indulgences which they are either unable or unwilling to give up. The average or normal man, this is back on our second level here, is thus apt to seek the solution of his conflicts by socializing them with a somewhat lowered conscience threshold and comforting himself with the thought that he is no worse than his neighbor. And even the church, the institution which seeks to represent that which is permanent and universal in human society, tends constantly to introduce shortcuts and protective devices in order to bolster up the moral self-respect of its faulty members. The church, in other words, which should be one, gets hijacked and brought down to level two. Constantly. That's just a constant tendency. This Dharma Shidwani. The church becomes over particular about creedal conformity and ritualistic niceties, and in other ways it tends to substitute minor for major virtues and loyalties. In trying to get God to come and meet Satan, our patient was therefore merely giving expression to the common tendency to seek divine sanction and approval for compromises made in the interests of human frailty. There is thus constant interaction between the needs and frailties of the individual and the ideals and standards of the group. The individual judges himself by the standards of those to whom he gives allegiance and with whom he wishes to be identified, and to be unable to stand before the inner tribunal means for him isolation and destruction. For the sake of his own mental health, he must be at one with some group, and his frailties may lead him either to shift his loyalties to a group of easier standards, or else to lend his influence to modifying the exacting requirements of the group to which he may belong through birth and early training. The presence of the protective devices with which organized religion is so encumbered means simply that the church is made up in large part of individuals who are trying to serve two masters and are thus not ready to meet the conditions of their fullest self-realization. Well, that's really quite enormously perceptive about what happens to organized religion. So ISKCON is becoming an organized religion. When we become successful, we become an organized religion. And I noticed in America there have been a series of newspaper articles that have been increasingly more favorable toward ISKCON, which is good. I mean, it's very good. But the reporters, they like to see the devotees as now they're not so strict. Now they're not so standoffish. Now they're not so fanatical. And in some ways, the reporters are very happy. As long as we maintain high standards, it's as though we stand in judgment to them, and they're very happy to see that devotees are maybe coming to a lower standard. Some of it also is just recognizing the fact that they're grihasthas who have regular jobs, and you don't have to lower your standard to do that. But in other cases, you can see the reporters are actually looking at devotees who have having a lower standard and saying, yeah, see, they're normal too now. Yes?
Sometimes someone can just become a religious worker, in other words, a rabbi or a priest or a minister, something like that, and it's just a job, and you're doing your job. And
that's one way of doing it.
You have your obligations to your clients of your congregation, and it just becomes a routine you do, and it's a job you do, and you're not thinking about spiritual realization.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get in a rut like that.
Yeah, you can sleepwalk your way through your life that way. Sure. Because you forget. I mean, a devotee who's alert should always be, on edge about how do I make spiritual advancement? What is the obstacle I have to overcome in order to make spiritual advancement? To us, we'll talk about this later, but to us, to me, it's the difference between attentive and inattentive chanting. It comes summed up in that particular activity in many ways. You can always, to me, how attentive or inattentive our japa is almost symbolizes, what we're doing, how far we're distracted from our real goal or not through our life all day long. But we have, because of the chanting the holy name, I think, a special facility to remain alert. And when the chanting, when our japa is done officially, because we got our hand in our pocket and there's this little nish 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 while this click 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 nish 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 nom nom nish 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 click 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 is going on, you can understand what's happening. It's all too revealing, and you can be a pujari or something and do everything right, and yet. Anyway, we'll talk about all these things more. Let's just. So now we're down to this. That's as far as we've gone. The last group in which socialization takes place, the attitude is dependence and idolatry. The means is reflected glory through identification with finite leader or love object. End result, submergence. He gives two examples, the partisan, the clinging vine. Now this is a particularly interesting sort of way of socialization. We would say fanatic, a zealot, and we are in some ways acceptable to this in our movement because of the relationship of guru and spiritual master. And you can see these formations sometimes take place within our own movement. And so I thought we would pause and look at this a little bit. Because he discusses this... let's look at the area we are here. Yeah, he says, let's go back to this chapter here. Submergence, I'm on page 154. A type of solution seen in morbidly exaggerated forms in certain neurotics who are constantly seeking sympathy and must have someone to lean on. It is also encountered sometimes in the psychoanalytic situation known as the transference. So we'll... I guess we lost power, huh? You have batteries on that one? But you can't... Yeah, this is working. Okay. It is seen likewise in some individuals who, because of a sense of inward insecurity, identify themselves with other individuals or institutions or causes in the effort to maintain their own self-respect. This tendency is responsible in large part for sectarianism, super-patriotism, and so on. Now, he talks about transference at the end of this chapter. And we should look at this because we're sometimes criticized. I remember when we were... There's a devotee, name is... Bhaktisiddhanta Das in California. His father's a psychiatrist, and he was in charge of part of the psychiatry department at University of Pennsylvania Medical School. And I had some relationship with him while we were dealing with some anti-cult people. He was defending us against the anti-cult movement. But he was a Freudian, and he thought that the relationship between the devotee and a spiritual master was one of transference, which he said was regressive. In other words, one goes back to an infantile stage where one is like an infant, and the person with whom the transference is made is seen as all-powerful, all-wise, all-knowing, protective, parent figure. Maturity means you break that transference relationship. And so he tended to think of all devotees as immature because of this transference. And I was like really heavy to see ourselves in those kind of, you know, clinical terms. He was so sure about it, you know.
He seemed like he would be in a very good position to defend us.
Well, he thought, well, while we may have had that shortcoming, we weren't stark raving mad, you know. And I talked to him a little bit about this. So I thought we'd spend a little time on this today, because Boysen has the proper understanding about this transference relationship, that it's not a bad thing. I mean, it also happens in the psychoanalytic transaction. Now let's look what we say here. We have to say, and page 161, he's talking about the influence of a physician when there are favorable outcomes of a reorganization. The influence of the physician must not be forgotten. I'm in the middle of the paragraph on page 161. It was not the mere bringing of the difficulty out from the realm of concealment into the light of clear consciousness which did the work. There was also the social factor, which the psychoanalysts recognize in the doctrine of transference. He calls it a doctrine because he rightly intuits that psychoanalysis is a kind of secular religion. According to this doctrine, as it was originally formulated, this is by Papa Freud, a certain attachment on the part of the patient toward the physician is to be expected in all cases in which treatment is successful. This attachment must be recognized as part of the process of treatment. That is to say, that analysand, I think the term is the person undergoing analysis, the analysand, falls in love with the analyst. The analysand falls in love with the analyst. This attachment must be recognized as part of the process of treatment, and it must be utilized. And then, in order to complete the cure, it must be broken up. This has been explained as due to the fact that the physician becomes for the patient a, quote, father substitute. That is equivalent to saying that in order to help a nervous sufferer, the physician must be for him a representative of authority. So here Boysen is immediately going a little further than Freud. I mean, Freud is an interesting study in the case of somebody who should have been a rabbi but was fallen. You know, and his quarrel with God, and his quarrel with his father, and his whole Oedipal relation with his father and with God is very interesting. I could do a whole thing on Freud, but we don't have time. In laying bare to the physician his inner difficulties, the patient places himself at the bar of judgment and gives to the physician power to bind or loose. If the physician, after hearing the story and knowing the worst, does not condemn, he, the patient, may feel himself restored to right relationship with those whose love is necessary to him. He may feel himself forgiven and able to meet his fellows with head up and hope in his heart. And in saying that before the process of cure is complete, the transference relation must be broken up, Freud has recognized that no solution involving an attitude of submergence can be a satisfactory one. No man can be dependent upon another human being, whether physician or mother or wife, and yet be free and well. Now he goes on. This is Boysen. That's Freud. Now Boysen. The structure of the personality must be built upon the enduring foundation represented by true religion, he says. The individual, as Professor Mead points out, must learn to respond to that which others also respond. Such a common object of response is best found in the supreme loyalty which in most men and in most societies is represented in their idea of God. So Boysen has a more complicated idea of what this, certainly not Freud. And I'll read you a few more things. So it is true, you see, that this is accounted for in Krishna consciousness, that the spiritual master has to represent God. And this representation, being representative of God, has to happen on two levels. It has to be recognized, of course, that the spiritual master actually has to represent God by speaking what God speaks and by being, in fact, a disciple of his spiritual master. But also has to be seen by the disciple as representing God. When the disciple has a relationship of dependence on the spiritual master, which is independent of the spiritual master's relationship with God, then you have submergence and idolatry. This takes place in our movement, and we'll discuss that. So in one sense, there has to be a breaking of a transference, if there is a transference in the sense that it's based on a finite love object. But the spiritual master has to be seen not just as an individual, as a finite individual, which the spiritual master is, but as a finite individual in relation with the infinite individual, therefore represents God. So that the affection and feeling we have for the spiritual master becomes identical with our affection and feelings for Krishna. That's what has to happen. So let me just... go to this other place here. Now I'm reading from this other book.
According to Freud, when that transference relationship is broken up, where's the foundation of personality?
I don't know. I don't know enough about Freud. And the doctrine, as he says in this long footnote, the doctrine of transference in Freudian circles has gone through many changes. And, but let's look at this footnote before we go on. He mentions again, he discusses this trance. In particular, the patient is apt to invest the physician with attributes of those he has known in the past who have been for him representatives of authority, hence the attitude of affection. He also talks about the negative transference. And also Freudians talk about the counter-transference, that is the attachment the analyzer, the analyst forms for the patient, which has also quite often broken the bounds of propriety and ethics. A rather shockingly amount sexual relations between them. Anyway, go ahead. I'll answer your question.
So this can be. Is this? But are we talking about codependency? Do you know the term codependency?
Why don't you explain codependency?
It's kind of an emotional involvement that people. They depend on each other, but it's an enmeshment. It's not a real relationship. The Just for example, you know, somebody become like spouses become so attached to each other, and one of them dies, or there's a divorce or something, and that person just kind of completely loses.
They have no autonomy.
They have no autonomy. They have no.
So that would also be another version of this, whether it be a mutual transference or something like that. Now, Boysen, in this article, Theology in the Light of Psychiatric Experience, talks about spiritual maturity and the sovereignty of God. And he's dealing with a case history. Of a man who was reasonable and self-reliant, but when he got married, things changed. After several years of wandering, he married a young woman from his native town in Sweden, whom he met in this country, an attractive person of considerable force of character. With his marriage, his entire manner of life is changed. He becomes now a devoted husband and father. His evenings are spent at home, or at least in the company with his wife and daughters. Aside from his labor union, he belongs to no organization. It is therefore clear that his wife was now supreme in his system of loyalties. His entire life was built around her, and his love for her was for him the equivalent of a religion. I believe I quoted you that saying of that Argentine writer Borges about a man in love is someone who has a religion with a fallible God. And a Juliet says to Romeo, God of my idolatry. Now this is what happens here. So his love for her was the equivalent of a religion. There is in this nothing unusual. Sex love, as Professor Hawking points out, he always quotes Hawking's statement, is closely associated with religion. Not that religion can be explained in terms of sex, but that sex love at its best approaches religion. Both seek somewhat the same thing, union with the idealized other than self. But it is also true that sex love seeks something beyond the finite love object, and that it cannot be satisfied with the finite. It seems fair to assume that this law was operative in the case of this simple mechanic. It was not for him sufficient to have reorganized his life around his love for his wife. He had undoubtedly, after the manner of lovers, sworn to his readiness to give up everything for her sake, and his picture of himself was that of a devoted husband and father. But the actualities would sometimes become a bit trying. As a rugged, self-reliant male, he found it not always easy to submit to her domination, and he probably became uncomfortably aware of attitudes within himself which were at variance with the undying devotion which he professed. The problem of his ultimate loyalty was thus pressing heavily upon him. That's which led to his crisis. We may therefore hazard the guess that the source of strain in this case was not so much the sense of guilt as the need of achieving a higher level of adjustment, the level represented by the psychoanalytic doctrine of autonomy and the Christian doctrine of the sovereignty of God. At first thought, these two doctrines may seem opposed one to the other. We submit, however, that the proposition that they are really contributory to each other.